Good evening. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Enter freely and of your own will. In this episode, you may find many strange things, for the films to be discussed are old, and they have many memories. So, beware. Beware.
That spooky Transylvanian accented voice you just heard means you are listening to the one and only Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Deep dives into your favorite classic horror, Universal and other films of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and sometimes even 50s. This is Jim Towns. I'm your host, and I am joined once again by Chris Salen, a self-confessed horror movie maniac. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing good, Jim. Thanks for... as Ian likes to say, it's good to be back on the pass.
Good to be back. It's good to have you back on the pass. I'm enjoying all the new blood we have on the show this in the last few months and stuff. This has been great. Tonight, we're talking about Sherlock Holmes and the Scarlet Claw, which finds the world's greatest detective prowling the moors of Canada for a murdering, glowing ghost who has a penchant for ripping out the throats of its victims. I understand that you're a big fan of this particular, of the Holmes movies, but of this particular one, Chris.
Yeah, this was my first introduction to the Holmes films, and I was sucked in, and I never left. It was probably like in the late 80s. Key Video came out with a whole series of the entire Sherlock Holmes series, and someone at my work said, "You got to check this out. I know you like old movies," and it was like just the perfect, it should have been Sherlock Holmes meets one of the monsters. You know what I mean? That kind of has that feel to it.
You know, they really could have done it. And I also realized at the times they were producing this, they could have done Sherlock Holmes meets Abbott and Costello, or Abbott and Costello meets Sherlock Holmes. I mean, they really could have done one of those.
Right.
We talk about all the monster, you know, MASH crossovers, but yeah, for sure. They could have had Sherlock Holmes, Frankenstein, and Abbott and Costello.
Yeah.
But what such was not to be. This is the... depending on who you listen to, this is the sixth Holmes film made with Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. The fifth by Universal, because Fox had made Hound of the Baskervilles starting out the series before Fox took it over. So it starts out, obviously, Basil Rathbone as Sherlock Holmes, Nigel Bruce as Dr. John Watson, Gerald Hamer as, and we're going to get right into spoilers here, folks. So if you haven't, obviously, it's a Sherlock Holmes movie, so it's a mystery. So if you haven't, you know, we're going to spoil the ending. I don't know. There's no way around it. Who plays Potts, Tanner, and Ramson. Gerald Hamer was also in Sherlock Holmes Faces Death and Terror by Night. So he was kind of a regular on this series. Paul Cavanaugh, who we were just talking about when we did our episode on Mystery of Dr. RX, plays Lord Penrose. Miles Mander plays Judge Brisson. He was in Tower of London and Return of the Vampire. Arthur Hull plays Emile Journet. Yeah, I think the thing horror fans are going to know him best from is playing Montgomery in the 1932 Island of Lost Souls. He looks quite a bit different in this. He's you know, it's 1944. It's 12 years later, and you know, he's obviously an actor, and he's playing a very different type of role. Kay Harding plays Marie Journet, his daughter. We talked about her when we talked about The Mummy's Curse, and she was also in Weird Woman. Ian Wolfe plays Drake. Ian Wolfe has one of my favorite lines in The Raven. He's like, "Never stand behind people." He's Pinky in The Raven. He was also in Mad Love, Bedlam, Invisible Man's Revenge, and Strange Confession.
He's got some good. He's got some good lines in this one too.
He's got some very good lines. Yeah, no, he's good in this. And especially when he's drunk, he's great.
yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah, Victoria Horne plays Nora. She's in Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer. Boris Karloff, and she's also in Harvey. She's great in Harvey. Everybody, I think I've talked about this before. I know it's not a old black and white horror movie, but Harvey with Jimmy Stewart is just a wonderful,
fantastic,
brilliant, funny, hilarious classic film. And if you haven't watched it, just take a break from the horror, go watch it, come back, watch more horror. It's okay. We won't judge. Gertrude Astor plays Lady Penrose in kind of a brief cameo with no lines and stuff. It's basically she just plays the dead body. But she's, I found out what she was in The Cat and the Canary. So she went back a ways.
The original Cat and the Canary? Like 20,
yes, yeah, the silent. Yeah, the silent Cat and the Canary, yeah.
Wow.
And Skelton Knaggs is also credited as a villager in this film.
Yeah.
Obviously, Skelton is most known for House of Dracula, Invisible Man's Revenge, Isle of the Dead. I think he does more than that, though, and I want to talk about that when we get to it. It was directed by Roy William Neal, who directed Frankenstein versus the Wolfman, and he also did a bunch of these Holmes ones. He did Sherlock Holmes and the Secret Weapon, Sherlock Holmes in Washington, Women in Green, Pearl of Death, The Spider-Woman, Sherlock Holmes Faces Death, House of Fear, Pursuit to Algiers, Dressed to Kill. I mean, he seems to have been like the main director of most of this series.
Yeah, and he wrote, actually, he was co-screenwriter on this one, too.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Sharing it with Edmund D. Hartman, who wrote Abbott Costello and Society, The Naughty 90s. And he also wrote, he's got a writing credit on The Shakiest Gun in the West with Don Knotts, which is, talk about another awesome old movie that's not a horror movie, but come on.
That's a spanning career.
Yeah, right.
You know, you talk about that quite often with some of these directors and such that work their way all the way into like the early 80s and late 70s.
Yeah, and I think one of these writers or directors, I mean, I looked them up, and they also wrote like Mannix and, you know, like My Three Sons episodes and things. They produced these shows and stuff like that. Yeah. Their career went all the way on into the 60s, into the television, the golden era of television. I should mention there's also story by credits for Paul Ganglin and Brenda Weisberg. Brenda Weisberg and Ganglin both worked on Mad Ghoul, and she also did Mummy's Ghost and Weird Woman, one of the few female screenwriters of her era.
Nice.
And it's obviously based on the story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. We are happy to be watching a restored version of this film from it was restored by the UCLA Film and Television Archives with a great labor of assembling different prints and scouring and finding the best versions of things, restoring them, putting them together, and then being able to release a great version like this.
It wasn't easy work.
No, absolutely. The DVD set I have has a whole documentary on just the process that they went through, and it's really neat. Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to get into The Scarlet Claw from 1944. The film starts with the bell tolling across the village of Le Mort Rouge, which translates to the Red Death in English, with creepy fog and trees. Again, this bell tower, some like matte painting stuff, real universal stuff. Yeah. I mean, there's...
this is classic Roy William Neal direction. He had an innate sense for atmosphere. I mean, just when you think of a horror movie, you know, I mean, think of the opening scene to Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. You know,
right, exactly.
This could have been in the same village, you know.
Possibly one of the best opening
ever
scene of any Universal horror film, and maybe up there with the best opening scenes of any film. That the two grave robbers trying to, you know, steal the jewelry off the body of Larry Talbot, and then, you know, the moon
hands down and stuff.
It's
not even close.
just incredible. The way the slow build of it is just excellent. I mean, he's an incredibly talented filmmaker. And these weren't, I mean, just like a lot of films during the war era, these were done on an assembly process at Universal and you know, tried to, you know, shot and edited and put together quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing slapdash about this production. It's of quality piece of production on Universal's part. I think they're very proud of the series that they were doing.
I think this was, if I'm mistaken, one of the first ones that took him out of modern day war. I mean, they were blatantly modern day, and this one I think took him back to an ambiguous period where you know, you had cars and you had horse drawn carriages and old European villages, but it's in Canada, and you're just like
the universal metaverse, right, where everyone has all the different accents. There's you're right, like you said, there's covered wagons, there's airplanes, everything's mixed up, and we're not sure if it's 1880 or 1940. That should be said that this series does take Sherlock Holmes from the 1880s and 90s, mm-hmm. where you know, the stories were written as contemporary stories of the time by Conan Doyle at the time. Conan Doyle dies in 1930, so this is made only 14 years after his death. But it takes Holmes and Watson and transplants into a contemporary era, which Universal is kind of good at, because they kind of did that with Dracula too. It's sort of Bela Lugosi's walk around and there's cars going around, so it's kind of the 30s, you know?
Right.
Again, this nebulous time zone of whatever. But you're right, some of these films really had to do with World War II and stuff. So they take a 19th century character and transform him into the mid-20th so that he can go up against, you know,
Nazis. I think they might have been too overtly modern And this was a way of bringing him back to those, you know, the old,
neat.
It had the old gaslight fog.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh, the feel. Old town and fishing village and everything. Absolutely. Totally. And it really feels, while it's supposed to be Canada, it obviously by the look of it, you know, Canada looks a lot like Transylvania.
It could have been Visaria. It could have been
Visaria. The town of Frankenstein. Exactly. A lot of the same folks hanging around too. Some amazing faces, I just want to say, in the tavern, which we spent a lot of time in Journay's tavern and hotel in this film. Wow. Just amazing faces they cast in, some, a lot of old folks, as is this old, like, quote, fishing town.
Yep.
Potts the mailman, who, spoilers, is played by Gerald Hamer.
not even holding off on that one.
Like, yeah, I mean, you know.
You can't really.
You can't, or else I'm going to be talking in circles, I think.
He has the first line. He has the first
line. He does, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a great, and, you know, we'll just say it, it's a great red herring where you know, you don't expect the villain to be the guy coming in the beginning, starting off the movie. Mm-hmm. There's been sheep killed, weird glowing figures been seen, and now there's a bell tolling that nobody knows who's doing it. This is all similar to what happened 100 years ago in this town, where there was a series of killings by a ghost that glowed green, is the town's legend, and it seems to be happening again, and the whole town is terrified. The local priest argues that there's a logical explanation, which I think is funny, that the priest is the one saying, no, there's a logical explanation. It's not supernatural, right? Because obviously being a priest. And he goes to investigate who's tolling the bell. Potts, the mailman, takes him in his carriage, drops him off because he's got a delivery for Lord Penrose, and he continues on. The priest finds that there's a woman in the church who's holding on to the bell, and she's been ringing the bell apparently for help because she was attacked, her throat was slashed, and she bled to death, obviously ringing the bell, hoping someone would come, which someone came, but
too late,
unfortunately. Yeah. Yes. We quickly discovered that the dead lady is Lady Penrose, Lady Lillian Penrose, mm-hmm. and more accurately,
Lillian Gentry.
She's an actress. Yes.
Yeah.
Lillian Gentry. So we find out that she's actually, Lillian Gentry, Lady Lillian Gentry Penrose. And again, played by Gertrude Astor, who was in the Canary 20-some years before this. The priest goes to Penrose Manor, and he finds Drake the butler, who's played by Ian Wolfe, mm-hmm. Pinky from The Raven, as we know him, and the mailman are there. He tells them the lady's been murdered, and he orders them to call the police. Instead, Drake actually calls Quebec, Canada, which is, it seems to be the nearest large city to where we are here in Le Mort Rouge. And he calls Lord Penrose to let him know, obviously, that his wife has been found and that she's been dead. Lord Penrose, played by Paul Cavanaugh, is at the Royal Canadian Occult Society meeting, where Sherlock Holmes is also a guest. And here's how we establish why Sherlock Holmes is in Canada and not in 221B Baker Street.
It perfectly sets up, I think, the dichotomy between science and the occult. If you go back to even like the Hound of the Baskerville, because, you know, in this scene where they're attending this conference, actually Dr. Watson breaks out with, the two cases that he brings up were Hound of the Baskerville, mm-hmm. and I can't remember the other one, which were more occultish cases. And yes. We're kind of left with the fighting the scientific with the occult and you know, belief systems of a little village that might be outdated.
Very much so. Confronted with the epitome of a modern clinical mind, Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And I guess he's been invited to this occult society meeting as kind of a devil's advocate. I think there's this idea of like, well, we're going to have Holmes here, mm-hmm. and try to convince him of our thing. Now, we're talking about a cult, and I think in 2024 or so, or, you know, in the last couple decades, we want to conflate that, the occult, with devil worshiping, and I think that's kind of a product of the satanic panic of the 80s.
Yeah,
thank you very much, Tipper Gore and everybody else, which Chris and I are old enough to remember.
Yeah,
firsthand. But in this case, what we're talking about is a group of people who are more believers in the supernatural,
mm-hmm.
Ghosts. Telepathy, astral projection, things like that. It's more metaphysical than it is have anything to do with Satan or anything like that. So these aren't evil people because they believe in the cult. They're not the devil worshippers from
Rosemary's Baby. From the seventh victim.
The seventh victim. Yes, exactly. These are decent folks who just actually believe in that there's more on earth than is dreamt in our philosophies, as Shakespeare would have said. And presenting here is Lord Penrose, played by Paul Gavinaugh, who's arguing that the reemergence of this glowing ghost in Le Morte Rouge, his little village, is proof positive that such a thing exists. And Holmes is like, well, first of all, you're just talking about something, so that's not proof that exists.
Right.
and what I like is he always says, like, you know, you can present all these facts, but if you draw the wrong conclusion, it doesn't matter. And that goes to the heart of Holmes's process, right? Like he's presented with evidence, and it's the way you put all that together that leads you to the truth. Not you can put those things together in a bad way and not get to the truth.
Yeah, the conclusions drawn from fact are in error,
yes.
Right?
Yes, exactly. But the critical thing is having all the data you can. Because obviously he's an unbeliever. And I think it's interesting that they started off with this, and I'll just divert for a second, everybody, but because Arthur Conan Doyle, the author and creator of Sherlock Holmes, in later life, he himself became fascinated with the supernatural, and even he got involved in this whole social uproar kind of thing about these fairy photographs that were, you know, all the rage at the time.
Yeah.
And if he wasn't a believer, I guess you would call him like a hopeful skeptic. Mm-hmm. I think he was trying to help prove maybe that these things are possible.
Wasn't he the one that was at odds with Houdini when Houdini came in and started debunking all this? Was that him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not especially, but...
I thought it was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle that he...
They were friends. He and Houdini were, yes. I was going to talk about this too. Yeah. He and Houdini were really pretty good friends. And it's like, you have to imagine like these two guys' popularity. It was like Stephen King hanging out with David Blaine right now. Like that's the equivalent, right? These guys were superstars. The Holmes series were wildly popular and Houdini had a massive cult following. The preeminent stage and escape artist of his era. They're both a little older at this point. And Houdini's mother had died at some point. And Houdini was, like, I don't want to call Harry Houdini a mama's boy, but he was close to his mom. He was very close to her. And he started going to a bunch of seances and mediums to try to contact her from beyond the grave and sort of realized that the large proportion of these mediums and such were hacks and were just bilking grieving people out of their money because they're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And he made it his goal to start going out and debunking these mediums. It became his passion. So this is what he and Conan Doyle kind of fell out over, is Conan Doyle's continued belief in these things and Houdini's. Yeah. So that more or less, as far as I understand, ended their friendship. Holmes refuses to believe that, you know, in what he's saying, and their conversation grows kind of heated. Penrose gets kind of rude with him, and Watson, who's there with him, Nigel Bruce's character, gets all offended for Holmes's sake. Penrose is called away, and he's told of his wife's murder, which is she's been killed the same way these animals has been killed, with her throat torn out. And he comes back and says, obviously, that, you know, he needs to go home, and that the meeting's adjourned. And kind of all bad blood is, well, on the Holmes' part or anything like that. You know, Holmes doesn't really even get offended. He's like, nah, you know, that's what it is.
I don't think Holmes...
He's just excited.
Has the ability to be offended, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So this cold mental thing. Yeah, exactly. And yet Rathbone manages to play him... a little more human, I guess I would say, than a lot of iterations, you know. He takes these moments to get excited about things and to, you know, he does show that, I mean, Holmes isn't a robot, right?
Right.
He exists in a very logical world, obviously. I mean, but he's not Spock, right?
No.
he's got the passions. Yep. The next day, as they're leaving, Holmes receives a letter from the at the desk of the hotel. They're just about to go and get on their plane and go back to England. And he receives a letter that was written by Lady Penrose before she died to him and reveals that she feared for her life. He instantly cancels his flight home to London and tells Watson that they're going to Le Morte Rouge. And he's got this great line saying, for the first time, we've been retained by a corpse.
Yep. Classic.
Love just, it's good stuff. And
Watson is like, well, good thing we're not going to go to this. And he's like, yeah, we are.
Exactly. Yes, we are, Watson. Yeah, Watson's along for the ride. Watson doesn't really make a lot of choices. We'll talk some more about it. I talked about Nigel Bruce's incarnation as Dr. John Watson a bit when we did Baskervilles, but we'll go to it more here. Just one more little thing, because I outspoke the pace of my DVD and I've got to let it catch up. Everybody, it's not like I'm just doing this extemporaneously, okay? Come on, it's 2 hours. I think at some point I posted on our Instagram saying I was thinking about doing some of these Sherlock Holmes movies, and I got quite a lot of support. People were like, and I said, do people think we should do these, include these in the Borgo Passport podcast? And overwhelming people were like, yeah, you should absolutely do it and stuff like that. And a lot of people said, you have to do Scarlet Claw because it's as close to a horror movie as Sherlock Holmes series really kind of got. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting. And I watched it and I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, it is. And it has all the tropes of it. It does. There's a murder. There's, a body count, everything. Okay. And then that first time I watched it, but then I was like, yeah, I don't know if it really fits our mission here at Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Mm-hmm. And a little time went by. And then I realized, this is actually my podcast and I can do whatever I want. So I just decided to do it after all. But it helped that I mentioned to you and you're like, no, I'll definitely do Scott. It's because I always want to find someone who's really invested in the film to talk to you about. Well, it always makes for a better episode. So here we go.
I think it's such a good one to do because, I mean, it's not just, the story it harkens back to, Hound of the Baskerville. The sets that are used, they're universal sets. Yes. They're things that you've seen in the Wolfman, and in fact, I think there's scenes in here, where they go up the staircase and to the upstairs floor later on in the of a boathouse later on, which I think were used in mm-hmm. in probably Psycho and Cape Fear
the staircase you're talking about. Yeah. It's in the De La Porte Hotel.
Yeah.
It's definitely in, it's in Strange Confession. It's definitely the same apartment building thing that Lon Chaney Jr. and his wife live in the beginning of that film. And so I kind of like side by side matched them.
Oh, that's
and then
awesome.
One of the other, the judge's house, the staircase in it, I looked and it is actually the same staircase as the mummy's.
Oh, right.
Mummy's
on.
Tomb. It's Mummy's Tomb. And I am pretty sure, I looked it up, I'm not entirely sure. I think it was redressed in the interim, in the 10, however many years interim. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it's the same staircase that factors in towards the end of the Twilight Zone episode, I Sing the Body Electric.
Ooh.
I'm pretty sure it's the same. It's the same set. It's been rebuilt and redressed a little bit, but I'm pretty sure it's the same set.
So, go back to that. A lot of these Holmes films, but especially this one, share so much of the DNA of everything we talk about and we love about Universal Horror, and they share the same talent. And there was almost a troupe that did these movies.
Right on.
And I can tell you from, there was a book that came out in the 70s. It's called Sherlock Holmes in Film. But I distinctly remember reading that the cast and the talent that was working on this movie particularly, they knew at the time what they were doing was something special and they enjoyed it. They had a blast.
That's great.
So
it is so you're absolutely right. It just dovetails with it. There's music from Son of Frankenstein and the Wolfman all throughout this, by the way, too.
Yep.
Like it's just, so it does, it absolutely fits in, and I don't know what I was thinking. So whatever.
Yeah.
They get to Penrose Manor and they find they kind of let themselves in and they find Lord Penrose standing vigil over his wife.
Creepy. Like they just kind of walk into his house while he's mourning.
Exactly. And he's legitimately like, what are you doing here? Like, hey, do you mind? And so he escorts them back out and they're going to talk about why they're there. Penrose is convinced his wife's death was supernatural in nature, and he dismisses them. He doesn't want Holmes there and stuff. And a lot of the way they treat Penrose in this film, and a lot of the way Paul Cavanaugh plays him, makes you want to suspect him of something. Yeah. And, you know, obviously his wife's dead. Does he have a motive there?
Yeah, he's a consistent red herring throughout the film,
For sure. And because he's really until the end not very nice, and he's definitely not a fan of Holmes. So that helps you, you know, and that has nothing to do with his wife's death. He just, you know, he's of one belief or something, and he finds Holmes's reticence to believe what he believes frustrating. So, and he, you know, he's also a lord of a manor, so he's kind of used to people agreeing with him, I think. And Holmes couldn't care less.
I want to be a lord of the manor. That's what I want to be.
I know, right? Exactly. The lord of your own manor. There's just great, I have a note here, just there's great camera work, lighting, set design in this. You know, again, this is what we talk about Universal, is they had really talented artisans working behind the, in front of and behind the camera. Mm-hmm. And you just got to, I don't know, this whole big, vast living room set, which is beautiful, in Cavanaugh's sets. I don't know what else this has been in, but it looks familiar to me.
Shot from inside the fireplace there.
Yeah, exactly. Know. I wouldn't be surprised if it's, I mean, it could have been on the same soundstage as Talbot Manor in Wolfman, and this is just a redress. I don't know.
Or Son of Frankenstein.
It's just incredible.
I don't know.
Son of Frankenstein, one of those. Yeah, exactly. Maybe one of the House movies. Penrose dismisses him, and then there's a phone ringing that nobody's answering, and he goes to answer it, and Holmes and Watson take the opportunity to sneak back into the room with the corpse of his wife.
They're persistent.
And inspect it. Yes, they are, you know, but, you know, Holmes feels like he's been engaged in this matter by the wife. So he feels like he's got a duty to
his client.
Solve her murder. Yeah. From beyond the grave. He doesn't really care about Penrose because in his idea, he's working for the late Lady Penrose. So, you know, in keeping with that mission, he's going to go and investigate the body and have Watson check the body, because we have to remember that Dr. John Watson is a doctor.
Yeah.
He's a medical doctor.
I enjoy seeing these little moments of Watson actually being
competent.
An authority.
not being a complete and utter buffoon.
Yep.
Because there's moments with Watson where, you know, and I talked about this in Baskervilles, where there's moments where he's pretty sharp. And there's moments where he's pretty heroic. Mm-hmm. And then there's moments where you're like, how did this guy get a medical license? Yeah. He seems like there's sort of something mentally wrong with him. Like it's like, you can't possibly be that dumb. Like and obviously it's done to make Holmes, you know, the dumber Watson is, the more Holmes seems brilliant, obviously.
You know, I've heard, you know, your discussion about the whole character thing with we don't like Holmes on our own, but we like him because Watson likes him, and that's what's
and
important.
We like Watson, yes, and that is the most important thing that I thank you for mentioning that. That Nigel Bruce brings is no matter what, how bumbling or whatever Watson can be, Nigel Bruce's character as Watson is eminently likable.
Mm.
You know, he's a nice guy. He's an older guy. He's a gentleman. I like the moment where he really gets mad at Journay for slapping his daughter.
Yeah.
Like Watson's ready to go. Like Watson is very upset. He very much cares about that young girl's safety. He's a doctor. That's his job.
Right.
In obviously the books, Watson's also a veteran. Watson served in Afghanistan and in Afghanistan or India.
I thought it was in India.
It's India. Yeah. Porter Rifles. He served with the British military over there. So he's seen some stuff.
Yeah.
And
he brings the heat.
He brings the heat. That's right. He's the one who usually has the gun. I think at some point the producers of these films decided like Holmes should, you know, get Basil Rathbone should get to do some action too. Cause he fires his gun quite a bit in this film. They go into look at the thing and Drake, the butler, shows up and he's apparently been fired and he thinks that there's a possibility that someone else is guilty of the thing, but he doesn't get to tell them because Lord Penrose comes back in and interrupts them. I don't know what other suspect Drake is going to tell them about. Because the next time we see him, he's drunk.
Yeah.
And about to leave. So that's interesting. I wonder who's
funny you bring that up, because I never made the connection that what information did he have?
What did he have? Because yeah. whatever information he takes on the bus to town because he leaves. Holmes and Watson are kicked out of the house.
Yep.
Paul Cavanaugh, by the way, is very good in this movie. He's very, very good. I like his look. He's almost of Holmes's caliber of like. He's got the presence of Rathbone. Yeah. You know, he can go nose to nose with Rathbone.
He's got the intellect. Yeah, exactly. He's got the vocabulary. He's got the look.
The aquiline features yeah. and everything. Yeah, he's really just a little bit rougher. Their next stop, obviously, they go to the police to talk to Sergeant Thompson, who's, I guess, you know, there's French Canadians and apparently there are Scottish Canadians because he's super... super Scottish. Yeah. David Clyde plays him.
Mustache he also played acting, the Welsh... right? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, mustache acting. I have a note about mustache acting. There he's doing go. Top... This is top-tier mustache
acting.
I just
set you up for
he's
that
got
one.
A lot to work with. Thank you. David Clyde also played the Welsh police sergeant in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. So obviously, Roy William Neal liked this guy playing Scottish. In that case, he's a Welsh... policeman. So I guess the Scottish accent works a little better there, but I'm sure there were Scottish people in Canada. There's no, we do have a little bit of some Frenchish thing. Obviously the name of the town, the Journays have a French last name, you know, nobody really has a French accent, but that's okay.
Except for, I think his daughter, but it's not really that great.
Oh, does she try to do? Yeah. She does a little bit of the accent. Yeah. Oui, monsieur. Oh, yeah, right. Exactly. She says some French words, at least.
She says some French words, yes.
Yes. Holmes believes correctly, like right from the beginning, his hypothesis, that the weapon is not a the means of these people's death is not a claw, like a hand or an animal's claw. It's a garden tool, like a sharp-pronged weeder type garden tool, like you would buy
pronged garden weeder.
Yes, like you would buy at Home Depot or wherever now. Which is, I mean, we're talking about connections to other Universal films. This totally connects this film in my mind to She-Wolf of London, right? Because spoilers, 3, 2, 1, spoilers. the claws of the werewolf in that movie turn out to be, the ant wielding a garden tool as a weapon. So there you go.
I didn't make that connection. Very cool.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, we did an episode on She-Wolf of London a year or two ago, and that was one of the things we had to talk about because there's not a whole lot else to talk about the movie because, you know, no werewolf. Anyway.
Moving on.
One of our least downloaded episodes. Anyway. Holmes actually, he makes another immediate conclusion that he believes that Lady Lillian Penrose was also once Lillian Gentry, an American actress who disappeared. Mm-hmm. He very quickly recognizes her. I guess maybe he was a big fan. I don't know. But it's one of those things where he knows like all the different types of tobacco and whatnot. So,
So he knows all these American actresses. Yes.
But it's a good first step in our mystery, leading along that we're trying to figure out, because as we go on, there's going to be more and more murders. And when Holmes's job is obviously to figure out what the connection is of all these different murders. And he finds out that there's a very clear connection by the end. So it's great. And we're not, while he's giving us some clues ahead of time, mm-hmm. that he's figured out very quickly because he's so smart. Those don't solve the mystery for us, the viewer. We're still left to piece it together as the more information comes in. They check into the Journay Hotel and they meet Marie, who's played by Kay Harding, who was Betty Ward in The Mummy's Curse, obviously, where she looks about 10 years younger in this than she does in that. It's just incredible. Like I had to double check to make sure I'm talking about the same person. And she's there. Huh. Cause she's made to look like a younger girl.
Yeah. Cause they're not that far apart. These films. I don't think they're that.
No, I don't think. I same year almost, I think. Yeah. Within a year at least, yeah. She's crying because apparently her father's departing, her father being played by Arthur Hole, Montgomery in Island of Lost Souls. He finds out she told them. He finds where they signed in on the ledger, and he finds that it's Sherlock Holmes. And when he confronts his daughter about telling him, he slaps her, and Holmes and Watson happen to be staying there, and this is when Watson gets all upset about the way he's... he's being on his kid. He doesn't approve of it.
Yeah. That's one of the moments that you brought up. There's a couple moments in this film where they act to the gravity of the situation where you're like, this is serious, you know, where you see Dr. Watson being serious and Holmes intervening in, you know, somebody battering their child. And then later on.
Because Watson's the hothead of the two. Watson's the one who actually does have a temper and he gets, you know, and Holmes has to pull him back a little bit. So it's funny. This give take back forth relationship between these two very different characters, and who are so ingrained in our pop culture mythology, right? That we just know who Holmes and Watson are. Mm-hmm. And they're such strong characters that they can survive however many different interpretations. The Sherlock show with the guys who were in The Hobbit. I'm blanking on their names. Benedict Cumberbatch and I'm blanking on the actor who played The Hobbit who plays Watson in that. Obviously Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law. Mm-hmm. You know, these characters, so the dynamic between them is so good that you can play the characters all sorts of different ways. Holmes can be weirder, more normal, likable, more action-based. Watson can be, you know, obviously Jude Law's Watson is a pretty tough guy on his own, right. Much more kind of almost in keeping with the character in the novels.
Well, I think that speaks to how they were written as characters. I mean, it's perfection. It's almost two sides of a personality.
You're absolutely right. I was just going to say they almost together make a whole person.
Yeah.
Exactly. Holmes tries to talk to Journay, and he does this thing where he's actually took the garden. He stole something from the police station, which I find funny. He took that little garden tool and he confronts Journay with it to see how he'd react.
Yeah,
and Journay's like, I don't even know what you're talking about and all that like
it's
that. So,
brilliant.
You know, you're never aware of what's going on in Holmes's mind. And Rathbone plays him so well this way. He's likable and you can follow his thought process, but you're never ahead of Holmes, right? You know, he's always because he is this guy. Holmes mentions legends and stuff, and he actually mentions werewolves, which I love because Dan, we're talking about like he just has this offhand remark about werewolves, and you're like, that's hilarious that Sherlock Holmes knows about werewolves. But Journay does tell them that he used to be a prison guard, mm-hmm. And that he's had the same premonition of danger as Lady Penrose. Right. This premonition is never. Here's the thing I like is this premonition that he, the Lady Penrose and the judge later on all talk about having is never explained within the context of the movie.
So
the movie itself sort of argues that there is something supernatural going on.
That phrase is a breadcrumb for us. We're like, oh, wait a minute. That other guy said that. He said that too.
Yes.
Oh, okay. They're all connected in some way, shape or form.
Of course.
Until it's revealed.
Because they're right. Everyone who says they have a premonition of danger, they are in danger, all three of them. So, you know, it's up to us just as we go on the film to make the connection of why they're all connected.
So this scene where he confronts him he pulls out the garden weeder to Journay.
Yeah.
And, you know, the dude's like, I don't know. I haven't seen that. I've never seen that before. And then Holmes, he's just kind of like a sadist sometimes. He's like, oh, here, by the way, I mistakenly took this from the police station. Can you bring it back for me?
Yeah. I was just effing with you. Sorry. I just want to see how you do it. It's cheesy. Yeah, he is. He doesn't, you know, to the point where he is sometimes a bit callous. Mm-hmm. Because everybody within this world knows who Sherlock Holmes is. So if you're being questioned by Sherlock Holmes like this, there's a good chance you're in some trouble. Like you don't want, what if Sherlock Holmes was wrong about something? Because everyone assumes he's right. What if he's wrong? And like, yeah, you might be in trouble. But anyway, this is why Journay was going to leave town because he's had this premonition and stuff. And now he's decided that he's not going to leave town. now Holmes is here. Mm-hmm. So it's now later. And Holmes, I love this. Holmes tasks Watson with getting to know the townspeople. And he says, go, you know, go downstairs, be subtle. Don't draw attention to yourself, whatever you do, right? Mm-hmm. Because, and he says, I'm going to go to bed early and get a good night's sleep for tomorrow, which I think we all, if we know Holmes well enough, we know like, no, he's going to go out and do his own thing and not tell anybody what he's doing. That's how he operates. Right. To the point where he sometimes doesn't tell, not only does he not tell Watson what he's going to be doing, he actually uses Watson as a distraction because he knows Watson's going
to... Yeah, everyone's going to be paying attention to him in the inn.
He's going to drink too much red wine, and he's going to get loud, and he's going to start holding court. He's going to do the exact opposite of what Holmes told him to do, but that's what Holmes was planning on, that he was going to be a big distraction, and therefore leave Holmes free to just wander around unmolested and everything. Because... it's like I said, the Baskervilles episode, like you have to keep in mind that Holmes is famous within the context of these films. He's a really well-known person. He's like, you know, Linda Carter.
You can't really do covert operations.
I don't know
why
I went to Linda Carter, but like, yeah, he's someone that people know his face. And if he goes around, he's going to know, which is why he has to disguise himself sometimes, but also why he has to do things like this, where he, you know, has the big distraction and Nigel Bruce is great here with the liking the red wine and getting caught up, and he's trying to take little notes of things and stuff. And he's so well-meaning, I guess is the nicest thing you can say.
And it's really cool because then in the background, constantly in the background, are all of these faces, all of these characters that you saw first entered the inn. And they're constantly there throughout the movie. And so you really get a feeling of like, this is a real place. Kinda.
Yes. Exactly. And yeah, wonderful faces. Most of them don't have any dialogue. They're just looking on and paying attention back, and they just color the thing. And they're just a lot of older actors. Just very unique, you know, interesting faces. This tavern, by the way, is the same tavern. I'm pretty sure it's in The Invisible Man's Revenge. I want to say it's in one of the House of Frankenstein, either House of Frankenstein or House of Dracula movies. It was a running set, and this bar off to the right side is a pretty well-established thing, and I've seen it in a bunch of the films we've talked about in the last year or two. I'm not going to watch each and every one of them and make a list.
Do you think it was the same one that was in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman? You know, when they walk in and the guy's daughter is up on the table.
Yeah, no, that one's oriented differently. I do think that one's different, which is interesting, is these two were done pretty near each other. But at some point, I think this set went in there, and it's in quite a few. Oh, you know what it is? It's definitely in Mummy's Curse. The old woman's hotel that takes young Betty in and takes care of her, and then immediately gets killed by the mummy. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's in Mummy's Curse, which again is like I think 44, 45, right around this time. Because in that it's in New Orleans, in this it's in French speaking mostly Canada. You know, it doubles for everything. It's fantastic.
You know, if you came into this movie 5 minutes into it or 10 minutes into it, you'd never know it was set in Canada, because I think
they make very few references. They mention Quebec a couple times. They do a few things like this. And they make a bit about the interest in the scene about how Drake is taking the bus and whether they call it honking or hooting. and there's some argument about which one it is in England and which one how they say it here. And I didn't know that was a thing. Did they call it a hoot or a honk? I didn't follow the train of the actual thing. So
hoots to you, honks to me, or whatever says. I did.
Yeah,
I heard it. Hoot. It's hooter.
It's actually, we're talking about mustache acting, and Nigel Bruce does some high quality mustache acting throughout the film and stuff. He's got quite the stash.
Yep.
Older Journay goes up to try and have a conversation with Holmes, which I like because we're not sure about him. And at this point, he's going to go wake him up and talk to him. He's not going to, when he's sneaking in at first, you're kind of like, oh,
yeah.
But then he's going to talk to him.
You don't sneak. At that point, you're like, is he friend or foe? I don't know.
Right. And this helps us think like, okay, Journay's probably okay. So what's the connection here? Holmes, meanwhile, has gone to talk to the sergeant, and he's going to go out and look in the moors at the church. was his mission?
I think he was just going to go out and look around on his own.
Yeah. And the sergeant's like, don't do that. Yeah. There's a ghost out there. And he's like, come on, buddy. It's okay. Great. And meanwhile, Watson has drunk most of a bottle of wine, and he's holding court with Potts, with the mailman.
Yeah.
Well, which is fantastic.
Which is really interesting, because they start talking about a book called The Invisible Man, which G.K. Chesterton, who was it? They refer to the author and the book called The Invisible Man.
Yes.
And the actual book is about, they called it The Invisible Man because it was about a postman who infiltrated a town. And of course, nobody ever sees the postman. He's invisible pretty much,
Yes.
So it was an interesting kind of
fascinating
that they planted there.
While referencing a book called The Invisible Man, which, obviously Universal made a film based on the book of that title that was actually written by H.G. Wells.
Right.
G.K.
Chesterton, I guess. There was a detective series called Father Brown. And it was one of the stories in that series was called The Invisible Man.
I think BBC made like a Father Brown Mysteries series at some point, I think. Oh, that's cool. Neat. There we go. Thank you, PBS. Anyway.
Keep those donations coming in.
Yes. Potts wanders off. He's done with that. He doesn't drink. He talks about how he doesn't drink. And I think that's interesting because I wonder if because his real name is Ramson. So if I talk about Ramson, this is Alistair Ramson. I wonder if Ramson doesn't drink because he just doesn't drink, or I wonder if Ramson doesn't drink because he has to keep up a character all the time. And he's a little worried that if he drank, what if he drops the accent, or what if he slips or something like that, or says something we wouldn't know as this character. So it's great.
Dedicated to his crime.
He's kind of method. Yeah. Right. And really like, I mean, I guess it's, we'll talk about some more, but Gerald Hamer in this movie does such good work. I mean, he really manages to create this love of, like, Potts is kind of adorable. Like you'd like him and he's so goofy. And the film does such a good job of like establishing the postman so well. And the thing that I honestly like I was rewatching this, and I just watched it a year or so ago, and I was like, wait, it's him, right? I wasn't sure because you forget. You're like, it's such a good idea of, well, okay, we'll get to that. I guess I don't need to spoil.
And the little red herrings they throw in throughout, and it's always that look, they'll mention a character and then they'll show that character like looking sideways, from
underlit. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Just so you get, and even Journet, having discovered that Holmes is not there, sets out after him, and walk down this street that's covered in fog. That's just like the most incredible looking. It looks like Jack the Ripper is going to step out of it at any moment, or Mr. Hyde even. He goes after him. Holmes is out on the moors, and we have quite a few sets here with the moors, which again, right out of the Wolfman. I mean, just incredible looking fog and these trees and stuff. And you got to keep in mind that this is not outside. This is a set. This is something they've constructed and built and have to enclose and then refrigerate so that to some degree, so that the fog hangs low. You have to actually chill. Anybody who's had a haunted house or anything, right? You got to chill the fog through a thing to make it makes it lay low. Otherwise you end up just with like a soupy kind of,
mist
makes it look like everything's out of focus. Yeah,
you're shooting a cloud.
Yeah, absolutely. So it must have been freezing cold on these. It's spoilers to everybody. It's freezing cold on most sound stages because you keep them very cold because the lights are hot. But in general, yeah, they're cold. Sergeant Thompson comes running in, and Watson, who's drunk, well, I like this bit. Well, Watson finds out that Holmes is out on the moors and the bell's ringing. Which is, was ringing the last time someone was killed, when Lady Primrose was killed, and Watson just immediately sobers up.
I was going to say
like,
that.
And goes after him. Like, he's just like click. Wow. Great. And it goes to show.
But that's classic Hollywood. Everyone's drunk, stumbling around. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, is something serious going on? I'm ready to join. Let's do it.
He doesn't have to throw a glass of water in his face or anything like that. Slap himself a few times. Holmes, while he's out on the moor, is confronted by the glowing ghost, with special effects, thanks to John P. Fulton. who's basically, I think, taking a figure in a probably a leotard or something like that, in some kind of dark clothing, and then rotoscoping around and adding a glow on top of them. And it's great because, you know, the we'll call it the glowing ghost, it runs behind trees, and when it runs behind trees, like, the trees block that glow and stuff like that. And they're doing that. Fulton and I assume his crew too,
right,
are doing that frame by frame by frame by frame. It's very, and the thing's moving very quickly. It's incredibly, it was technically incredibly complicated to do back in this day. Yeah. And yes, exactly. Yeah. Time consuming. And the fact that they were able to do it is just incredible. Holmes just starts shooting at it, which like talk about like deductive reasoning. It's kind of like, well, I mean, we assume the glowing ghost has something to do with the murders, but we're not really sure, but Holmes isn't taking any chances and he just starts gunning for it. Which, okay. You know, there we go. I think it's time in the movie we have a little bit of action. So this is a good bit where, you know, he managed to do it. The thing gets away though, but it manages to tear off a piece of its clothing on a tree. Holmes discovers it and discovers it is, you know, first of all, it's not a ghost. It's a real thing. And in a kind of a Scooby-Doo moment, shall we say?
Yeah.
It turns out it's just wearing clothes that are painted with phosphorescent paint that would glow in the dark.
I like the way they did it too. They didn't make it look like just like, you know, the 10,000 volt ghost from Scooby-Doo. It looked,
yes,
you can tell it's a human who's out doing nefarious things, and he just happens to be glowing.
Right. And he's not trying to cover up for a counterfeiting operation or smuggling thing, as is always the case in Scooby-Doo. Right. Holmes also finds Watson, who, while going out to rescue Holmes, has managed to fall in a bog and has to be helped out. So there we go. And that's a good setup because we're going to have a repeat of the bog bit with Watson towards the end of the movie. Holmes has to take him home and get him dried up and everything because he's, you know, filthy, dirty, and he's all wet and everything, and he has to, you know, be taking care. So we have this moment where Holmes is very limited, much like a caretaker, which I think is great.
I think it's a good, it also shows their relationship for a moment, which I think is awesome because, you know, he's kind of backhandedly, you know, making fun of him, blah, blah, blah. And then Watson goes, I deserve to share in your dangers. And he goes, I appreciate that, you know, old fellow. Like, it's you get that these guys are brothers, you know.
There's a real bond, and that's like the other side of Watson, like I think we've been talking, is that Watson is the only one who does almost manage to bring out like the human side of Holmes. Mm-hmm. The other time being when young Marie ends up getting killed, and we do see Sherlock remorseful and you know, feeling guilty that he wasn't there to protect her and stuff. It's a nice human moment. He's less nice with the maid with Nora when he discovers her. He's a little bit like, okay, I'm just gonna leave now.
we'll talk about that when we get to it.
Yeah. So while, you know, he's nursemaiding Watson, he's getting ready to leave, and Penrose shows up, and then we have a bit where, like, I just, for some reason, Basil Rathbone plays like this whole scene with a coat half on one shoulder and not on the other, and he's just wondering, it takes forever for him to finally get the rest of his coat on, and I'm not sure if Rathbone just got stuck with that or just, you know, they kept it.
If you listen to the commentaries on the film, it's made, they make a note of that, and as I was watching this last night, I've seen this movie probably 75 times over the past 30 years. Mm. I noticed that we'll get to Judge Brisson. He has a shawl, right? In a scene with Sherlock Holmes, has his shawl hanging off one arm the entire time. And so I never ever noticed it until last night. And so my mind is trying to square that and the only thing I can think of is like if it was intentional, I don't know, but maybe it's a way of making it seem like the character is so focused on what's going on right now that he's not thinking about putting his coat on. He's
That's
like,
interesting.
I've lost my train of thought what I was doing because this is so important. So I don't.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's unimportant to him. Holmes doesn't care if his one coat's hanging halfway off or whatever. Right? Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea. You know, Rathbone plays a very coiffed Holmes compared to what other actors' incarnations have been, and even sometimes in the stories that Holmes has moments where he's quite between cases where he's really disheveled and, you know, doesn't care about everything. Obviously he's using cocaine in the books, which he does not use as much in this version.
When you talk about things like that, like priorities and what you keep top of mind and what you think about. And I was always fascinated with this one part. I don't remember what book it was in. But Watson is describing Holmes, and he's describing a conversation that he had with Holmes one day about how the Earth travels around the sun. And he was aghast that his friend Sherlock Holmes had no idea how the universe worked, how our solar system worked. And when he was faced with that knowledge, like, why don't you know this, Holmes? And he goes, you know what? It doesn't do me any good. And that was his whole philosophy, is I do not think of anything that does not further my goal.
Does not. Yeah. Exactly. It's like the Albert Einstein story, which I'm not sure if it's apocryphal or not, but it's referenced in Jeff Goldblum's The Fly movie, the Cronenberg film, I should say, that he wears. Gene Davis asked him why he wears the same clothes all the time. And he's like, I don't. I have six sets or whatever of the exact same clothes, so I don't spend any of my mental energy deciding what to wear.
Right.
And apparently that was I learned that from Einstein. I don't know if that's absolutely true or not, because frankly, I've seen lots of photos of Einstein wearing lots of different types of clothes. So I don't know, but maybe at some point. Again, like I said, Penrose shows up and he refers for the second time to Watson as his assistant. And when Watson stops him, he's like, I'm not his assistant. What do you stop that?
Yeah, I take offense to that.
he takes offense to that. He gets huffed up about it. Holmes makes the choice to lie to Penrose and tell him that and not tell him about finding the cloth. And again, it confesses to Watson that he did that to try and see how he react. And it seems like, because he tells Penrose that he's very frustrated and he might not know, you know, a way forward in the case. And Penrose seems relieved about that, he says. So I don't think Penrose is off Holmes's suspect list at this point.
Holmes is really good at being chill. He can keep things close to the vest. And he's like, I'm going to play with this guy for a minute and tell him that I don't know anything. And I'm not going to let him know I know anything. So.
Yes. Yeah. He takes the scrap of cloth that he didn't tell, Penrose about, to the police station, and they inspect it under a microscope. What's fun about this is, as opposed to, Holmes is always making fun of the police and talking about how incompetent they are and Lestrade, everyone being adult and everything. It's funny in this one that this Canadian, maybe they didn't want to offend Canadian people. Like the Canadian police, he's just a police sergeant. He's not even a detective. And he's actually pretty competent and sharp. He's not, you know, he's not a genius or anything like that. But
Holmes confides in him all along, everything he's doing.
Yes.
And he knows he's
Canadian. He can trust him.
And he knows this man has relationships in the village and he can find out things and
exactly such as having the local shopkeeper show up and identify the weave or the pattern or plaid or whatever you want to call it of the shirt as a shirt, something that he orders in especially for a retired judge who has moved to the town, and that is Miles Mander, who plays Judge Brisson, who like I said, he's in Tower of London. I think he plays the Paper King, right? He plays the old King Henry who has been deposed, and they keep him in a tower, and they make him believe he's still the king, but he's addle-minded now. And, I guess obviously he has what we would now call senile dementia. He plays a much more serious character in this, and he's fantastic in it. So his next stop is obviously to go and talk to the magistrate. Who supposedly is in a wheelchair after the results of a stroke, which is what made him retire and come to the countryside, or he says it happened shortly after he retired and came there, right?
Yeah, he had a stroke and was wheelchair bound, and that's why he retired to the small village.
Mm. he has a housekeeper named Nora, who's played by, again, Victoria Horn from Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer, Boris Karloff. She's awesome in that. He's paranoid. He keeps the doors locked. There's bars on the window. He keeps a rifle ready because he has had been having the same premonition as Journay and as Lady Penrose had. So, you know, he feels like, you know, something's out to get him. And he doesn't want Holmes to come in. He's gonna keep Holmes and Watson, outside. But they've convinced Nora to let them in finally. And talk to him, and he says, like, you know, your life is in danger. His premonition is correct. Holmes is convinced that his life's in danger, and he needs Holmes's help to protect him. Nobody in town wants Holmes there.
Like, no,
it's like I mean, I guess the police sergeant, but Penrose and this guy, you know, everyone, mm-hmm. everyone does. No one wants Holmes in their business here. It's interesting. He's not in London. He's not. In his own zone, he's out of, you know, he's like Larry Talbot in Lenwilly Village a little bit, like he's an outsider. And they don't trust him.
I think it's brilliant writing and taking the actual victims and targets and turning them into red herrings. Well, you don't know. They're like, yes. Are you friend or foe? And you know, there's this judge right. who's got his gun trained on him. He's like, get out of here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Holmes just stares him down. Holmes just goes, you know. All right. And then he obviously outsmarts him because he walks out, he pretends to drop a letter, pretending that they're okay. We're gonna leave. We'll leave you alone. He pretends to drop a letter. After a minute, the judge gets up mm-hmm. out of his chair and walks over to pick him up, and then Holmes comes back in and catches him.
Yeah.
And he realizes that the judge has been using his, he was disabled temporarily after his stroke, but then he did regain the use of his legs. But he's maintained this ruse that he's bound to a wheelchair. They use a much less kind word to refer to his physical condition, but I'll just say they use it several times. He's confined to a wheelchair.
Makes it easier for the village to accept that he's a recluse, you know?
Yeah. Cause he really just wants to be left alone. I don't think it's even that because he's only recently started to feel threatened. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't want to be around people. He wants to be alone. So he uses that as it's pretty extreme, but okay. You know,
But again, clever Holmes, you know, first with the garden weeder, right? And then this with dropping that letter. And of course, you know, it's kind of tantamount to throwing the book behind the guy who's faking that he's hearing impaired.
Yeah. You know? Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like clapping him. Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to talk about the scene. I keep getting distracted by Victoria Horn. She's really pretty. She has that really dark hair and stuff. But she's, you know, she can be sinister. But again, in Harvey, she's hilariously funny too. She's really good. I need to watch more stuff that she's in. That again, possibly not horror necessarily horror related. I just have a note about Nigel Bruce playing Watson like there's something wrong with them sometimes. Like, imagine if this guy's your doctor and he walks and he starts knocking things over and falling over and stuff. And you're like, you know what, man? I'm feeling better. Well, never mind.
Actually, this little scene here at the judge's house before they get in the house, right? There's a scene where Watson is freaking out over the dog. And he's like, oh, my God, the dog's not going to kill us, is it? And right. Holmes looks at him and he goes, everyone knows that if you're with the dog's master, it won't do anything. And Rathbone flubs his line. And you can tell because he grimaces and he looks up to the left and he kind of like shakes his head.
I have to rewatch that.
And they
laughed
at him. I thought it was really cool. But this scene where he throws the letter down, where he drops the letter and the judge gets up out of his wheelchair and picks it up. And then Holmes comes in and he's like, oh, excuse me. Can I trouble you for that letter? I dropped it by mistake.
That's right.
And I remember Holmes comes in, he's like, Holmes, are you crazy? And he goes, no, Judge Brisson has promised not to shoot us, so.
Yes, I like that, yeah. And then Watson sits down, there's this nice moment where he sits down and looks and the gun's pointed right at him on the table. And he just moves it just enough so the barrel's not right at him. But I like that even though he's been discovered, the judge sits right back down in his wheelchair to have the conversation with him. they discover that they don't refer to it as such, but his specially made shirts are basically, he has like flannel shirts because he's an old guy and he gets cold and he wears a nice,
and they're made of
comfy
the finest,
flannel shirt under
the finest material.
Whatever. Of course, yes, because he's a retired judge and he has the finances to do such a thing. But And then he has like the other plaid shawl on top. But we find out that this one shirt he had, his old housekeeper gave to someone who did garden work for him. Just because it was old, and Holmes has already established that it's been washed a lot and everything, so it's kind of threadbare. So he just gave an old shirt to a guy who, that guy, it was a new shirt. Mm-hmm. So that's how whoever's been wearing that shirt, that's how it got to them. Do we establish how it gets to Ramson?
Maybe he was.
Was he the gardener?
Maybe he was the gardener. They never tell you who it was.
One of his. Yeah. That's true. There's a little connection there. I think we have to make ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's okay.
Because he had a limp.
You know.
The judge says, I remember distinctly seeing him out
there. No. This is how we, this is how we do. And he says the gardener had a limp, and they go and check and see how many people in this little town have a limp. Obviously, the police sergeant will know. And that this leads them to the Delaporte Hotel, which is I guess at one point was a hotel, and now it's basically abandoned. And this one guy that they know as Tanner is staying there. And he's, I guess, like an odd jobs kind of guy, who just does it here and there. The sergeant takes him down to the Delaporte. And in the, I didn't listen to all the commentary. In the one bit of commentary, whoever is the guy doing the commentary mentions that if Ramson thinks he's alone here, he doesn't know that that Holmes and everybody are there yet. They hear him limping and dragging his foot. And the commentator says, why would he maintain the limp when no one's around? Right. Why would he maintain the thing? And I mean, my answer would obviously be, it's kind of like what you said. He's committed to the role, right? If he's in one of his costumes, he's going to maintain doing that. It's almost like I said, it's like method acting.
Right.
Like
that's interesting. I never thought about that. I never made the connection of why is he playing this out? Cause, Potts doesn't have a limp, so.
No, of course. Right. I think the other option is that he might have anticipated that Holmes is coming or something. You know what I mean? He might be ready for him. It seems so. Even before they get
there,
he might
be thinking, he knows he's there in the village. So
he's pretty smart. He looks like the Tanner disguise is great because there's a scar and there's a beard and a wig and stuff. And he almost looks like he looks a little bit like a Civil War general. A bit like a pirate. He's got totally different accents and everything like that. And it's amazing because this actually, the character of Ramson, of course, is a master of disguise. But what we're seeing is with the aid of someone else doing his makeup, obviously, Gerald Hamer's a bit of a chameleon too. He's able to do this. And I don't think the first time I saw this, I had any idea that this, Tanner character is played by the same character who plays Potts.
No, I didn't either totally different. The first time.
I mean, it's great. Yeah. I think the coat's bulked up, so he looks, because Hamer's a pretty slightly built guy.
Yeah, he is.
You know what he looks like as Tanner? He looks like Rasputin. That's who I just realized.
He absolutely
looks like Rasputin with the beard and he's wearing kind of almost like a robe and a sash kind of thing. Holmes talks to him.
It's him and Sergeant Thomas and Thompson, right?
Sergeant Thompson, yeah, escorted there. Tanner is reticent. Obviously, he doesn't want to talk to him. Demands like, "Am I being interrogated? Am I a suspect?" Or, and Holmes has the great idea. He blows out a candle, and as soon as the light goes out, they see that flannel shirt hung up on the thing glowing. So they've now made the connection that this is. This is the gardener with the limp and him having there that then obviously implicates them. So, the bad part about blowing out the candle though is it's really dark in the thing.
Should have been ready.
Exactly. And there's this great bit where Tanner then brushes them all past them all and dives headfirst through a window out onto the balcony and then dives into water, which is just cooler than anything. I mean, it's really like Ramson is a physically very agile man. And also what we're seeing is sort of, I think, almost a recreation of how he escaped prison too, right? Didn't he dive into some water and they
He dived into water. They never recovered his body, so they just assumed he was dead, which is what all police do. Yeah,
of course. No,
They never drag the river.
They assumed the creeper was dead. Yeah. You know, and look what happened, right? They put a bunch of slugs in him. Watson Sergeant Thompson, they both fire at him and they both think they hit him too. They're pretty convinced.
Yeah.
And I think they're proven that they're not as good shots as they thought they were because he has gone away. In searching the room, Holmes discovers under the mattress of the bed, he discovers half of a signed photo and it's addressed to a man named Alistair Ramson. We're going to learn obviously pretty soon that it's a photo of Lady Lillian Penrose, nay Gentry,
right.
her maiden name. And I think Holmes has already, figured that bit out. But this is the first introduction of the name Alistair Ramson. Does Holmes know about Ramson as an actor, or is he revealed that by?
I don't.
When he talks to Penrose.
I don't think they actually make reference to that. I think he sees the bottom half of the photo. Does he see her name on it, or does he just know that's Lillian's photo?
I don't. Yeah, he seems to know, but I'm not sure.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, he knows because he knows that there was somebody in whatever prison it was that was put away for murder, and apparently he worked in an acting troupe. I guess. I think.
Okay.
So then he made the, he put the connection together, I think, through that.
Which is then confirmed by when he does confront, he breaks into.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so funny. He breaks into Penrose's house again and breaks into his, he actually has to jimmy open his little box on the desk there, and he finds the other half of the thing and he finds that it's over, and Penrose tells him and tells the audience that Alistair Ramson was an actor in the same troupe as Lady Penrose was back when she was Lillian Gentry. Mm-hmm. Ramson killed one of the actors in the troupe. He murdered him and was sent to prison, was sentenced to death, and then tried to escape and was shot trying to escape and suspected to be dead. And this is, I guess, what kind of ended Lillian Gentry's acting career after this. She didn't want it because it was someone she cared about that was killed. And that's what made her quit and leave, and then obviously she comes up to, she marries Penrose, becomes a lady, so obviously doesn't have to worry about earning a living anymore, but also kind of steps up in the social structure too, right? Now she's more or less nobility.
Well, there was something in Canada, there was some reference made to if he couldn't have her, nobody would. Later on, the villains divulging of.
Yes. So basically he was like a rival for her affections with Ramson. And so Ramson kills him because of that. So it makes sense then. So Lillian Gentry would have felt kind of responsible because the death was over her more or less.
I can't figure out though. I mean, Holmes is a badass. He knows everything we don't. He's way ahead of us all, but I don't know how the hell he knew this the top half of that photo was in a safety deposit box in the wall safe house.
Right. And how do you know it's like a bloodhound, how he goes right for it and discovers it. I wonder if when he does connect the photo, it's of a woman. And I wonder if it's a photo of Gertrude Astor as a younger woman. The actual actress, around the time, obviously, she would have been doing Cat and the Canary, 20-some years before this.
Oh, yeah.
Because we never see her real face
when
the priest discovers her, because obviously, her throat's mutilated and we don't show that kind of thing in 1944, so, so we can't see what she looks like now. Obviously, Gertrude would have been a woman in her 40s or 50s at this point. I like to think that they just went and found a photo of her when she was much younger and reprinted it and used that.
Yeah, probably.
That'd be kind of a cool thing. So now we know it's Ramsden. And what we, the other thing we've realized is that Ramsden, because he's an actor, he's a master of disguise. He's basically Lon Chaney Sr., right?
So
the villain of this is kind of a Lon, like a man of a thousand faces, which is my other connection to Universal, which I think is the coolest
thing.
They
go as far to show his makeup table, and later on where they find his lair. You know, he's got wigs and grease paint
and everything. Yeah, it's the coolest thing. And it's the real thing about this movie that I think is, obviously, with, you know, Rathbone being awesome as Holmes, and I'm a big fan and all that, but the crux of this movie is this idea that this guy escapes prison, he escapes the death penalty, basically, mm-hmm. moves to this little town in Canada, and adopts not just one, but multiple identities, and keeps this going for, it's been at least 2 years mm-hmm. that this has happened. So like it's such a wild concept that like imagine this guy has to stay in character all the time. Now he's actually lost Ramsden to some degree because he has to be either Potts the postman or Tanner, this ruffian guy. Right. But I like that he picked like a ruffian to play. He picks one guy no one's going to suspect, and he picks another guy that maybe everyone would suspect.
It's yeah, an and they're idea. As far apart as you could be. One guy is a drifter and, you know, not in the good graces of the community, I can imagine. And then Potts, who is just, you know, everybody probably, you know, he touches everyone. So, yeah.
Right. But isn't being a postman a great way to, like, keep in the know of what everything is happening, right? Like, again, like you said, like, he's everywhere. Holmes has just a great line that he says he could be anyone, which is a great chilling, like who he could be Sergeant Thompson. He could be, you know,
and he could be
Maria.
He also throws it back deliberately when he's talking to Lord Penrose. He goes, it could have even been Drake, your butler. So
yes.
Drake has left the film for a while, but now you're like, whoa, but was that all planned?
What if it was Drake? That's right. What if he's gone? Well, he said he left, but didn't.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, yeah. And then we get this connection, which we're going to learn, you know, down the road. But we, you know, he kills Lady Penrose, obviously, because she, you know, didn't want to be his girlfriend or, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's a long-seated grudge.
Unrequited
love. He obviously went to jail over her. Yeah. He's after Judge Brisson because Brisson was the man who sentenced him, and he's after Journay because Journay was the jailer mm-hmm. at the prison. So he's come here. I mean, I assume he's not here by accident. He's here on purpose, but it's been years now. He's been taking his time getting ready to exact his revenge. He's been integrating himself into the community. I mean, what a cool, it's a really great idea.
Yeah. It's a very, the psychopathy is huge, or the sociopath.
Wow,
I mean,
yeah.
The man is willing to be patient and, like, set everything up.
Yes, yes. And then he's relentless in his pursuits. So, you know, obviously this makes Holmes realize that the judge is in danger, and he's going to go and check on him. And the judge is like, it's okay, I put the dog away like you told me to. And Holmes is like, I didn't tell you that, which is, I love that moment. It's chilling because you realize not only can he look like anyone, he can sound like anyone. He's like, he can change his voice and he can sound just like Holmes. So like, now who do you trust? It's so creepy. Yeah,
I wrote down that this scene in particular, like, you know, we find these old mysteries in these horror movies, they're fun, right? They're fun to watch. They're fun to figure out. We like seeing, but there was something really dark and heavy about this scene when he realizes that it wasn't Holmes that called him. And then if we go through this scene, it is really unsettling for 1944 or whenever this movie was shot.
It is quite a bit. Yeah. It has shades of almost like Psycho a little bit,
and
when he disguises himself and everything. Yeah.
I made the connection to the 90s version of Cape Fear when the housekeeper.
Oh, right.
I'll let you go through this scene here, but.
And it turns out to be De Niro.
Yeah. It's kind of the same thing. You have this housekeeper.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, so I mean, if everyone mm-hmm. has already figured out, he took the place of the housekeeper. But they show him shutting the shades through the windows from the outside, and it kind of is him, but it's kind of not. And then all of a sudden, he's standing off in the dark corner, and he just starts walking out of that, and you're like, this is really creepy.
it's so amazingly creepy, and he's there. I mean, I think it's definitely when we see the shades being drawn, it's absolutely Victoria Horne. I can see her pretty well.
Right.
And this is the benefit of being able to watch something in HD, obviously, and rewatch yeah. and everything. So it's on the film's part, it's a bit of a cheat, but okay. Because we all know that the real Nora is currently
point,
at this point, tied up in a thing.
He's got a slight build. He's got a really soft
exactly.
face.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, as far yes. as it's very yeah. slender, he could put makeup on that and look, you know.
He can impersonate a woman and kind of, you know, sell. So, you know, maybe everybody in Florida is right. Maybe we should be afraid of drag queens. I don't know. No, I'm kidding. Those people are ridiculous. Anyway.
But this scene was incredibly yeah. unsettling. It
really is.
For the time, I think.
Yeah, it's psychologically really creepy. It's just, you know, the idea of like the person who's already in your house is not the person you thought they were. And you don't really get it until she pulls out or he pulls out like the garden claw, and then you see him stab down. You see the attack. You don't see
right.
Yeah,
down.
Yeah. It's really good. It is very contemporary. Yeah, it's just, you know, and it's a man who's not actually in a wheelchair, confined to a wheelchair, but you know, he's an older man. He's susceptible. Yeah. And the fact he picks this moment, Ranson picks this moment to do it while Sherlock Holmes is stuck outside. He's just outside the door. He's so close to being able to help him,
right?
And he's just barely not in time that it is.
And he runs right past him. When Holmes yeah, opens yeah. the door, he slips out. It's almost like he's like, I'm in control here. I'm in control.
Oh, he's
this.
Enjoying it, right?
Not
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He finally gets in. Yeah. And he thinks he's shoving his way past Nora.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Right.
And then finds the judge and finds that he's too late.
Finds Nora in the closet.
And finds Nora in the closet who's been, you know, tied up and stripped of her actual, I mean, she's wearing her like under clothes or something like that, but she's been stripped of her actual things. And this is the one I was mentioning earlier, how he basically just calls the police and leaves her there and tells like, oh, the surgeon will be here pretty soon.
Right.
And this poor woman's really traumatized. She's been right there where her murders happened. She's been attacked and tied up.
Yeah.
And,
it's not overplayed. It's to see a
poor
female
Nora.
in her undergarments in a closet yeah. with duct tape over her mouth, she plays it like she's yeah. really, really feeling the trauma.
Exactly. Yeah, Gertrude Astor, not Gertrude. I mean, yeah, Victoria Horne really, really sells it. She's, you know, huge range. It's really great. There's a moment here where the clock chimes, and I think that comes into play in just a little bit, and mm-hmm. Judge has a like a grandfather clock sitting on the floor. I mentioned that the judge's stairway door and everything is the same as in yes. Okay, so Holmes, we're kind of like rolling towards the end here. Holmes goes back to the Delaporte Hotel, and he's suspecting that Ramson will be there, changing into another disguise. And he is. He's correct. And we see Ramson from the back. You know, it's funny because Gerald Hamer has a big bald spot in the back of his head, which I noticed,
mm-hmm.
And Potts doesn't, which means he's, you know, it's a very easily identifying thing. And then so he's wearing a bit of wig, you know, he's playing Potts even like the energy plays most of. He's wearing makeup and a wig and everything like that and pretending to be someone else. And he's been doing it for years. And again, like I say, it's just the dedication and discipline that would require in someone who wants to take revenge
and,
to be able to do something like that almost every day.
There was a loss of life. He killed the postman who was coming to work in that village.
That's true. That's his first victim, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
He got assigned there and he kills the dude and takes his place. So no one's ever met Potts, so they don't know that that's not what Potts, you know, looks like. It's true. Holmes steps on a trick step that rings a bell that warns Ramson he's coming. And so when he shows up, Ramson has a flashlight right in his eyes and a gun pointed at him. So he's stuck. And this is where, like you said, there's, you know, Ramson takes the opportunity to divulge his entire plan, because he figures he's got Holmes dead to right. And he wants to tell him. He's proud of it, right? He's been living in secret yeah. this whole time. And
Holmes preys on that narcissism. He's like, you know, you're not going to.
Yeah.
I wouldn't send you to your grave without a couple missing pieces. And of course, the criminal is
right.
always happy to gloat. So
yeah, because he this is Sherlock Holmes. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
He's, you know, really doing so. Here's the thing about this scene that I want to talk about that I have a strong suspicion, and I don't know if you've noticed it, mm-hmm. Chris, or if this is something maybe you could go back and we can further discuss this on the Instagram and Facebook pages to see if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. It's definitely Gerald Hamer in certain scenes here, where in the shadows and stuff. But when he confronts Holmes, he's got the flashlight on him, and his face is all in shadow. Mm-hmm. We kind of only see like a bit of a silhouette. Two things happen that make me wonder, and then there's this idea that Skelton Knaggs is credited in the film as a villager, and Skelton Knaggs, if I'll say our fans will be kind of familiar with him from some of the other films he did, is. You're not going to miss him.
No.
Like, you know, he had a very certain look.
But that's bothered me because he's not in the inn.
No, he's not. I think this is Skelton Knaggs here. Oh. I think if it's not his face, I think it's his voice. If you go back and listen to this, once Ramson is revealed and he's running through the moors at the end, and then he and Holmes have their final confrontation, mm-hmm. and he's using what we assume is Ramson's actual voice. He doesn't sound at all like this. And this guy, Skelton Knaggs, in addition to having a unique look, had a very specific accent, intonation, you know, rhythm of the way he spoke.
Yeah.
It was this weird, syrupy, whatever.
I never put the...
If you go back and listen to this, I think this is Skelton Knaggs. I think, I don't know if they filmed it with Hamer and thought, if the producer or Roy O'Neill, whoever thought, you know, this sounds too much like Potts or something. This is obviously...
Right,
the audience is going to catch on, right? Just from the voice. So if it's not Skelton Knaggs's fate, you know, actual being doing this work, then I think they might have dubbed the voice with Skelton Knaggs. It sounds. I mean,
it's always bothered me.
I could be wrong, but it sounds so much like him.
It's always bothered me that I couldn't find him in the movie. I'm like, why do they keep saying that? I can't see him anywhere.
Exactly.
And now I think you've revealed it.
I think IMDb just has him erroneously credited as a villager and uncredited, because he is uncredited in the film. But, you know, I really bet. Well, I'm not going to bet money, but you know,
right?
Anybody out there, if you think I'm wrong or if you think whatever, I've been wrong before about things. It's absolutely possible. But I think this is Skelton Knaggs, and I think it's a great idea that they did to throw in this thing where. Even confronted, he's actually using a bit of a different voice mm-hmm. with Holmes, just in case, because mm-hmm. he thinks he's going to shoot him, but, you know, I don't know. Watson shows up, and instead of setting off the alarm with the step, he manages to crash through the steps and fall down the steps himself, like the ninja he is.
Yeah, he comes in through his buffoonery, and so it's kind of a two-sided, you know, he saves Holmes' life, which he said,
he
said, thank God you showed up when you did, but he goes, but damn it, man, he's like, I was about to hear who his next victim was.
Thank God you're such a klutz. Yeah, he's actually about to tell Holmes who his next victim is, and then that happens, and it enables Holmes to dodge away and get away from his line of sight, and the guy shoots at him, and he misses and everything, and Watson shows up. But it does, obviously it saves Holmes's life. So, you know, more power to you go roly poly, you fall down those stairs, whatever. Ramson escapes. But Holmes already knows he's going after Journay because Journay was his guard. Mm-hmm. Holmes and Watson discovered that secret room that we've seen him in where he creates all his disguises and his makeup and his wigs are there and all the different clothes and stuff. Journay has actually gone into hiding and nobody knows where he is. They want to go back and try and find him. And it's the sergeant, right? Says, oh, you know, he disappeared. He's gone. And so their next step is like well, we'll go back to the tavern. We'll talk to Marie, his daughter, Marie can tell us where he is. And they go back and there's all these people at the tavern. It's all, you know, over, and they can't find her. And for some reason, cause Journay is gone and his daughter, Marie, has disappeared now for a bit. I'm not sure who's like filling everybody's glasses at the bar because those are the only people that work.
But
at the bar,
we don't know how long ago that took place.
That's
true. Could have taken place 5 minutes before they got there.
It's true. It's true.
Because Potts.
And we see Potts. Yeah. Okay, good. This is the creepiest thing is Potts is in the bar.
Yeah.
Hanging out with everybody. And, you know, obviously if you follow the train of logic, you realize that Potts actually just killed a girl. And now he's there hanging out with everybody and laughing, right?
Yeah. And the way
that, you know, feet away from where the body is. And it's so creepy.
When you see Holmes and Watson go in there and they find her, you know, Holmes was like, she came in here with somebody she knew. And that was just really, that kind of gave me chills because...
It's very contemporary. You're right.
She came in here with somebody that she knew and she trusted. And then Holmes does something I don't see him do a lot in movies. He goes, I should have prevented this. I think that's what he said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because
we see regret. We see Holmes. Yeah.
There's people dying on his watch here.
It's true. He's been kind of powerless to help these people.
Yeah.
And he feels it. He's, you know, he's human enough that he feels, you know, guilt and shame. And Watson's nice. He's like, oh, it's not your fault, right, and everything, which, you know, it's not technically his fault, but, you know.
Yeah. You know, he's
maybe got a little.
I think three people have died or two so far?
Two so far since he got there. Yeah.
And,
yeah, I know.
So it makes you feel the gravity of this guy is bad. This guy is a badass.
He's smart enough to be outsmarting Holmes, yeah, to this point. Yeah. Which makes him a considerable foe, which, you know, obviously like the measure of a hero is the measure of his foe or her foe, or their foe. So,
right. Well, we're used to him dealing with, you know, Professor Moriarty and government secrets and things of that nature, the crown jewels of London. But Holmes is dealing with a serial killer here.
He's really a serial. You're totally right. He's a serial killer.
And it's unsettling.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what makes it feel so contemporary, like something like Psycho or something. Mm-hmm. That is really like learning. Holmes is out searching for Journay. All the roads are blocked, but the sergeant lets us know. So it's not like he could have gone away. So he's somewhere in the town. Holmes is searching for him. They get a call on the phone at the tavern, and he hears the same chimes of the clock from the judges, and that lets him know that it's a judge. It's a nice little moment where Holmes is, obviously his observational skills let him know that Journay is hiding out at the judge's house. So they go to the judge's house, and once more, just like the judge did, Journay has a gun on them. And he's paranoid. He doesn't trust anybody. Holmes has to tell him that his daughter's been killed. And that changes Journay's thing, you know, his stance, where, you know, Journay stops being afraid for himself,
right,
and realizes that, you know, he has to do what it takes to lure out the killer of his daughter so that guy can be, you know, that person can be brought to justice. So it's a nice turn for Journay, where now, you know, unfortunately here at the end, we see that there's, you know, a guy who's kind of been crude, and we've seen him slap his daughter. We're not sure about him. So that shows that, you know, obviously he loved his daughter, even though he liked,
right,
smacking her on occasion. Anyway, you know, but yeah.
Well, the sensibilities anyway,
by 1944 standards, I guess.
I was surprised they even berated him for it. And you know, back then, you know, people spanked their kids. And, you
know, right. Like, was, I know. Yeah.
Like, sensibilities
much more of a,
anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It was not is not the cultural taboo,
right?
Yeah, that we see it as now. So yeah, Journay decides to allow himself to be used as bait to catch Ramson, because they don't know where Ramson is, and they don't know who he is. He could, again, like I said, he could be any of us, any of them. Probably not Watson, but, you know, anyone else, because we haven't seen him fall over or anything. So here we are towards the end. Yeah. Holmes and Watson make a big deal out of that they're leaving. Like, what Watson does, that Holmes is supposedly upstairs in his room getting ready. Mm-hmm. And Watson's like, oh, well, you know, I guess the guy outsmarted us. Oh, well, we don't see that, you know, there's any conclusion for this. So we're going to go on back to London.
And you guys are on your own. Sorry, we couldn't do anything for you.
And Journay makes a, yeah, exactly. And Journay makes a obvious spectacle of himself leaving alone and walking away. And then, you know, the plan is that Holmes is already waiting outside. And as soon as Journay goes out, he's going to take his place and dress similarly. Mm-hmm. And he's going to wear like a false mustache and walk away with him. I remember one of the posters for this movie had the shot of Holmes and Ramson fighting, you know, from the end of the movie, and Holmes has a big mustache.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing it going like, did Pastor Rathbone grow a mustache? Like, that'd be weird. Holmes doesn't have a mustache. And you realize it's just, it happens to be wearing a mustache because he's still in disguise as, right. As Journay in this thing. So yeah. We're back on the moors. There's a lot of great, you know, walking scenes of, like, you know, we just see legs moving through the moors, and we've seen that before. This is how they did the first scene of Holmes walking through the moors. Mm-hmm. So it calls back, and you're like, oh, okay, it's this kind of thing. I neglected to mention that Watson shakes Pott's hands, and he says, well, I hope we get to meet each other again. I hope we, you know, whatever. So it just goes to show that no one is suspecting this guy. And Ramson obviously is delighting in the fact that he's hanging out talking with Watson, and Watson has absolutely no idea that he's the guy he's looking. I mean, totally. he's just enjoying the heck out of that.
Yep.
Potts, I guess, leaves, and having seen Journay leave, and he starts following him, and he's like, oh, let's walk together. Thinking that Holmes is Journay, and then we see, oh, it's a close-up of him. Like, I'm just watching it right now in the thing, right. where he pulls the garden tool out of his, which he must have had more than one, right? Because didn't we see the garden thing was left somewhere?
Yeah, he threw it on the table in front of Journay and said, take this back to the police station. That's where I got it. So it's a a common garden weeder. So
I get, yes, exactly. He could have had a few. Exactly. That's fine.
But I like to see, I love the way they're stalking through they're being stalked through the fog. We don't get clear pictures of everything. There's people like they're squinting through the fog. Like, they can't tell what's going on. And then of course, Potts comes running up, and he's like, oh, hi, Emil. Carries on a conversation with him.
Yeah, yeah. And he's going to do that. He's going to have this little conversation before he, you know, pulls out his thing and kills the guy. And, you know, it's not, you know, I think by contemporary standards, we look at this and see like a little garden tool, and we're like, well, I mean, it's not like it's a chainsaw or a M16 or something, you know what I mean? Right. As far as like death, you know, killer weapons go. Right. But then you look at it, it's like, it's probably sharp, but it's probably not amazingly sharp. And it's got these prongs in it that would grab into your flesh and tear
it, just rips and
so tears. You really think about it, you're like, that's actually really a ghastly kind of thing to contemplate, being attacked by something like that. No thank you.
I love your
garden implements at home.
I love this moment though when he's attacking who he thinks is Journay, right? And Holmes, and Holmes turns around, and they're going at each other, and Holmes it's the classic, he rips off the mustache, and he's like, Ramson, he didn't recognize him through the mustache. It's like the Superman thing with Clark Kent and the glasses.
And then he rips off his own mustache. It's like,
he rips off Ramson.
Let's just take off our mustaches and go at
Let's take off our disguises.
We're going to do this scene mustache less.
And he did it with such vigor.
Yeah. But I like that Holmes traps this guy who is a master of disguise by dressing up in a kind of a lowbrow disguise too. Plays his own game, right? He outsmarts him by doing his own thing. And so now the scene starts with Potts and Journay, and suddenly now it's Ramson and Holmes. Like without the characters changing, we're now watching two different characters. Mm-hmm. It's a neat, and it's a good, it's a bit of a fight. There's no kung fu or anything like that, but it's not a David Manners fight, at least. It's reasonably, I know I always talk about Basil Rathbone being like a deadly swordsman, and pulls just a rapier and just stabs the guy. Yeah. There was a few Holmes, I swear to God, and you're probably a better judge of this than me, Chris, I swear to God, I've seen, there's a scene where Holmes uses a sword, like, or you're just around the house or practicing at some point.
Yeah.
Am I conflating that?
Familiar. I don't know
I think they found a way to put a rapier in his hand for at least one scene or something. I don't know.
I'd say yes.
Holmes tells him, you know, the whole place is surrounded by people. You're never going to get away. Ramson still just tries to dart away through the fog, which is really like pumping right now. Like, there's so much fog. It's amazing. And we see like a real wide shot of this gully setting that they built for this. Mm-hmm. And we see people converging on them, and there's a lot of them. I mean, It's a big space. I'm not sure it's quite as big as the Hound of Baskervilles set that they built, which must have been gigantic. This is a big set though. It's cool.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a standing set on Universal where they always shot exteriors, or they built it especially for this or not.
But so it's just, you know, going back to the mustache being ripped off, and at first you're like, oh, that's kind of funny. But
we're back to the mustache.
But what's really interesting is that when he gets away from Holmes and he starts running through these moors and everything out here, if he still had his Potts disguise on, he could just sidle up to any guy that's out there, you know, bounty hunt, any guy that's looking for him.
It might be say, true. Or at least get past him.
You guys. We're looking for a killer.
You're right.
But he doesn't have his mustache anymore, so he's vulnerable.
So everybody knows him. Yeah, he's been straight. He's vaguely naked, or at least his upper lip is. And he's still got the garden thing, mm-hmm. and he's running. Everyone's looking for him, and then he eventually runs right into Journay, and there's Journay, you know, waiting for him, ready for him. And they fight, and Journay, does he stab him?
Mm-hmm.
I
think he shoves it in, under the water, and I think he took the garden weeder.
Oh, that's right. That's right. No, he drowns him at least, or he uses the weeder.
I think he uses the weeder, because when he comes walking out to Holmes and Watson and everyone else, he goes, "I killed him," you know, and it was like poetic justice.
Yes. Yeah. With his own weapon or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Have you? And it's, you know, Arthur Hole is great in this, and he's just, you know, like I said, I only know him as Montgomery in Island of Dr. Moreau, or Island of Lost Souls, I should say, which is a completely different type of character. And he's, you know, now he's older, he's got a mustache and everything, and he's just fantastic. But, mm-hmm. but it's interesting, you know, Holmes, I think part of the thing of Holmes is like Holmes can never, I think they care about Holmes just going around killing people, right, with a gun.
Right.
Because that's not what Holmes is about. Like he's not the equalizer,
right?
Or yeah. You know,
Dirty Harry.
Dirty Harry. Yeah, that's not, you know, he doesn't solve. He solves the crimes. He doesn't solve the crime with a gun. And he even says at this point, someone's like, "You're going to take him out, right?" And he's like, "Look, I'm going to get him. I'm going to bring him to justice. Right. I'm not an executioner. It's not what I do." Plus, he's in Canada. He's not even like. In his own country.
He's not in his own jurisdiction. Actually, Sergeant Thompson had jurisdiction.
You're right, yeah. You know, it's interesting. Does Thompson even have a weapon? And I don't know if Canadian police had guns. Because obviously, you know, famously, London police don't carry guns. And I don't know if that... I think that might have changed a little bit.
I think
in
he had anybody
could
holster on him, I thought.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. In his like, you know, kind of like uniform thing. He's got both hands as opposed to, you know, Lionel Atwill and Son of Frankenstein, at least. So he's more help. And of course the final beat of this whole scene is that Watson has once again fallen into a hole in the ground and has to be pulled out.
Right.
So
let's revisit that.
Good job. Good job, Watson. Yeah. Yeah. That's second beat in that note. And that's it, except for this, kind of odd coda where Holmes and Watson are driving to the train, to the boat, to the whatever is taking them home in like an open motor car. And Holmes, Basil Rathbone, has this whole bit of thing about Canada, this esoteric kind of thinking about Canada, where he quotes Churchill talking about two great nations and a race and the
right.
Western comes off a little odd sounding to now, yeah, but it's okay.
And how Canada's the great bridge between the two great, you know, the European and the North America,
it's
almost like the obligatory, we got to put some wartime propaganda in
here.
And because they do that a lot of the films where they just kind of throw.
Absolutely. These were patriotic movies made during, obviously it's 1944. We are in the midst of World War II at this point.
Right.
America, Canada, and England all on the one side. Yeah. I mean, it stops just short of being a war bonds commercial, but it's basically that. Yeah. And I think if you don't put it in the context to a modern sensibility, it comes off a little like, wait, what just happened? But you know, in the keeping with the time, like, oh, I get it. Okay. Makes sense. It's, and also it's, you know, okay, you know, serial killers are running around Canada with you know, dangerous large forks and everything, but overall, it's a good place. Let's not poo-poo on Canada.
That, I mean, that's what that they were originally going to call
released
it.
In Canada.
They were going to call it the Scarlet Fork.
The Scarlet Big Fork.
No, yeah. It didn't work. didn't test right with the audience.
But my thing is I like this idea of like, we're already seeing Basil Rathbone doing like Holmes is all like kind of hung. Obviously they're driving and it's cold and obviously they're all bundled up, but Holmes is all like, he's not this like totally like chin forward force of justice marching forward. Now he's hunkered down cause his case is done. And if you know about Holmes, like he's retreating into this kind of depression that happens to him in between cases. He's melancholy. He's thoughtful. You know,
I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to say he's got the classic arms crossed, guarded, and he's kind of going back into himself. And they're never overt about all that, but I think they do.
No.
There's a few, you know, if you know Holmes, you're like you just said, that's what he's doing.
They give you a nod to it. Yeah. And Rathbone knows what he's doing. Cause Rathbone was a giant fan of the character and everything. So he's happy as not happy as he was, you know, post this part of his career where he, you know, he kind of, cause he does however many of these Holmes movies. Right. Mm-hmm. And then he and Nigel Bruce also did an ongoing radio show where they played the characters that was incredibly popular. And Rathbone really, I mean, he did say, I've read in later life that he was, in the public mind, he became totally connected with Sherlock Holmes, just like other actors have, like Christopher Reeve as Superman and whatnot. And maybe he felt like that hurt him a little bit later in his career, like he was kind of stereotyped into that thing. But
yeah,
I mean, having said that, he at this point, he has just played, Wolf von Frankenstein. He's just played Richard III. Obviously, you know, and he was a classically trained theater actor. He was, as I said, amazing swordsman.
And at this point, he had seven more films to go.
Yeah, jeez, oh man. Seven, right? I mean, you know, I would argue even to, dare I say, anyone older than, 25, I think when most people think of the character Sherlock Holmes, even if they don't know it's Basil Rathbone, I think the image of Rathbone, which so much looks like the illustrations from the time period of the books of Holmes, is really connected forever in our pop culture zeitgeist as Holmes. It's the features, the aquiline, the nose, the everything.
Almost as, I think it's almost as visually, his portrayal of Holmes is likened to what we think of when we think of a vampire. We see Bela Lugosi. When we think of Sherlock Holmes, we see Basil Rathbone.
We do. Yeah, and I don't think anyone's and there's been plenty of great actors who've played Holmes since then. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Jeremy Brett and everyone else too that we've talked about. But yeah, exactly. Once in a lifetime, you know, like an actor comes along and just embodies a character so well that it does become difficult to separate the two, and for good or bad, you know, that's Rathbone in these films and stuff. Like seven more to go at this point, you said?
Yeah. And if you watch them,
that's what he's depressed about, hunger down in there. He's just thinking like, I gotta make seven more.
You can watch them too and watch his demeanor, and it's Rathbone's demeanor comes through Holmes in the 9th and 10th and 11th and 12th.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
But he's like, I'm done with this crap.
You know? It's.
But they're still funny. Good
he's
films.
He's really like tired of playing the same character and trying to, and he really, he and Nigel Bruce really got on very well, though, from what I've read.
They were really good
they
friends.
They really respected each other.
And when,
and that's kind of
neat. And when Holmes quit the radio series, because he stopped in like 1940s. I can't remember what year it was, but he stopped playing.
Rathbone quit.
Yeah, in 1946. Okay. You know who took his place? Tom Conway.
That's right.
You know, of all the lovely RKO Val Lewton films.
Yes, exactly.
Tom Conway took over the radio.
The Falcon, right? He did the Falcons. Mm-hmm. He did some of the Falcons, yeah.
So
movies, series of movies and stuff. That's interesting that Tom Conway. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I could see it. And obviously, like, if you're not seeing Rathbone, then who knows, what, you know, yeah, you know, but
they both have a very patronizing like delivery if they want to,
which is critical for the role, obviously. That's cool. So, all right. Hey, Chris, it's been good talking with you about this one. Thank you so much for your insight.
Oh, no, thank you.
Everything into these films. It's awesome. Cause they're not, you know, I've seen them. They're not as bread and butter to me as some of the other stuff we talk about.
Well, if anyone out there wants to take a chance on the Home series, this is definitely one to check out and it'll lead to others. So I'm always willing to preach the gospel of Rathbone and Nigel Bruce series.
What are some of your other favorite ones? The other ones I know that I like, I like Terror by Night a lot, which takes place on a train. Oh, that's really good.
If you put, give me a train and a mystery and I'm there.
I know, right? And then Women in Green, I think I've seen and I like that.
Women in Green is...
I need to watch The Spider-Woman.
It's good.
I haven't seen that one.
Spider-Woman's good, yeah. But I think when you want to, if you're just looking for the old dark house, the mist, the old classic... You want to go like House of Fear, Sherlock Holmes Faces Death, the Musgrave Ritual. They're holed up in an old mansion and thunder and lightning that stuff. And of course, Pearl of Death, where we Rondo Hatton and
Pearl
the Creeper
of Death with Rondo Hatton. Yeah, exactly. That's the other one I do need to watch because I want to see Rondo in that.
And again, they're all
that was his first. That was like his first. Kind of, he did that before he did any of the, well, obviously the Creeper ones and stuff. That was like, early on, in his acting kind of stuff for at least for Universal.
And
that's cool.
And they're all Roy William Neal directed. So the atmosphere is fantastic.
Fantastic. So talented guy.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Hey, everybody, thanks for hanging out and listening to us rap about the world's greatest detective and his bumbling buddy. Sometimes, occasionally bumbling buddy, occasionally quite heroic buddy. Yes. We'll say that. This is Jim Towns. I've been talking with Chris Salen about the Sherlock Holmes, and sometimes called Scarlet Claw and sometimes called Sherlock Holmes and the Scarlet Claw. I see it interchanged. Really fun. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. I'm not going to tell you what it's going to be. You're going to have to wait to find out. Ooh. But this episode is going to be posted in just like 2 days. We're only like 2 days ahead because Chris and I were talking about it. It's busy times around me right now. So, I'm not too far ahead of recording these episodes. We're laying the rails right before the track or right before the train. Here we go. We'll be back again. Obviously we have a plethora of episodes in our back catalog. You can check out if you're new to the podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We're very active there. We post all about, almost every day about, you know, some kind of old picture or some kind of neat thing I've discovered, keeps me, as I said, I'm busy, but it keeps me even more busy, but I do enjoy doing it. And you can interact with me and Chris, with Livio, David Allman, all sorts of folks who've contributed to the show are all over there. So thanks very much, everyone, for listening. This is Jim Towns. I'm going to say good night.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode, but the fun does not stop here. You can follow and interact with the show's hosts and listeners online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Borgo Pass Horror Podcast is a presentation of Shadow Camera Film and Entertainment. This episode was edited by Livio Marino. The music was composed by Sean Poole. Opening and closing narration are by me, Kat Herons. Show titles and graphics created by Jim Towns. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.